Gnosticism, the fifth talk in a series titled History of Christian Thought, was presented by David Crabtree on October 26, 1987, for McKinsey Study Center's School of Exegesis. McKinsey Study Center is now an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side. The following recording was made in a classroom setting, and many of the students' questions were inaudible. It is hoped that Dr. Crabtree's answers will be sufficient to understand the context.
The major alternatives that developed to Orthodox Christianity, the first major alternatives, are all roughly put under the title of Gnosticism, under the umbrella of Gnosticism. Yeah, the earliest, what become called heresies, most of them fall under the title of Gnosticism. I've already talked about the Judaizers. So that was the first heresy, the first alternative to Orthodox Christianity. And then when I was talking about Tertullian last week, I talked a little bit about Montanism. And if you will recall, that was started by Montanus and his two cohorts, prophetesses, and he said that Christ is coming soon and that the Paraclete, the Holy Spirit, was indwelling Montanus and his prophetesses. And they were the ones that said, we've got to clean up our act. The church has to clean up its act and get ready for Christ's second return. Second coming. And so that heresy, as it came to be called, was Montanism. Now, the others that occur early, this is in the second century, all fit under the title of Gnosticism, which comes from the word gnosis, which means knowledge. Now, you need to realize that this term was not used in the second century. This is a term that is used by his church historians now.
Gnosticism?
Gnosticism and Gnostics. They did not call themselves Gnostics. And that's significant because there's a debate over whether there are elements of Gnosticism in the early church that Paul is addressing. And for instance, in 1 Corinthians, the readings that you've been translating, you see the term gnosis being used. We have gnosis. Well, that does not mean that these are Gnostics that he's talking to, because they didn't call themselves Gnostics. Well, there's this whole family of religions that developed, and I'll talk more about it in a little bit, but they just wanted to term, they're so similar in many respects that they just wanted a term that would apply to all of them. The term that they used was Gnosticism, because the one common element is they all require gnosis. Now, there is one heresy that is usually called a form of Gnosticism, but it is somewhat different, and that's the Marcionites.
Say that again.
What's Marcionites? Okay, I'll get back to this stuff in a bit. Okay, the religious climate that existed in the 2nd century A.D. Remember that Rome started out as just a small country in Italy and gradually expanded, defended its way into an empire. It was always fighting defensive battles that extended its boundaries. In the late, like 250 and 200, Rome began to extend its boundaries beyond Italy. And so then when we get down closer to the switch from BC to AD, there was a lot of contact between Rome and the countries, the areas of the East in particular, but also in Western Europe. And the soldiers would go away and spend and do their tour of duty, which lasted at least 10 years in most cases, and sometimes much longer than that. So they would be stationed someplace for 10 years or more, and then they would return to Rome. When Rome first started to expand, its religion was one of animism, which basically everything had its own noumen, everything had its own god, kind of a divine force. So that a house had a noumen, the hearth had a noumen, everything had a noumen. And it was that noumen that governed whatever it was. But that's all it governed. They were just little tiny gods that couldn't do much, and they had a limited sphere of influence. As the boundaries of Rome expanded, they were introduced to other religions and other philosophies. And their gods really didn't stand up to the gods that they were introduced to, because they were on a completely different level. The result was that the Romans added whatever religions they came in contact with to their own native religion. They didn't see them, they didn't replace, they just added, they just kept adding. So the soldiers who spent 10 years in another area, that's long enough to be fully indoctrinated in another religion. They would come back to Rome fully indoctrinated in other religions. So Rome became a gathering place for all kinds of religious ideas from all over the known world. One result was agnosticism and skepticism. With all of these gods and all of these claims about all of these gods, it's impossible that it could all be true. And so people threw up their hands and said, this can't be true. I don't know how I can know anything about the spiritual reality. So agnosticism and skepticism was one result. It was a place where all of these religions came together and met. In fact, if you go to Rome, it's kind of interesting to see all of the shrines, temples, idols to all kinds of gods. I was in one area of Rome where there was a statue of the Egyptian Isis in this one section. And there are Mithraic shrines under most of the churches. And that's originally from Iran, from Persia. So it became, you could find out about basically any religion in Rome. So one result was agnosticism or skepticism about religion in general. Some people took that option. Agnosticism, yes. That you can't know.
Gnosticism.
Yes, it's not related to this. Agnosticism, agnosis means no knowledge. Agnosticism is can't know. The other result was to just add on. A priest of Apollo in Rome could very easily join one of these other cults, like the mystery religion. He could become a member of the Mithraic mystery religion. And so it was very common for the Romans to just add on. No, pantheism is a belief that God is in everything, and God, and everything is God. This is hedging your bet. Yeah, hedging your bet is technical term. The Roman gods, typically, we had a limited domain. And you just want to make sure that you're in good shape. So it's just like adding insurance policies. Just make sure you're really covered, that they've got you covered. And part of this adding together was not just to add two different religions, but to combine them into one philosophy, into one understanding of the world, called syncretism. So So it's the combining of religious elements from different religions into a new whole. Now, what was combined were elements from the religions as well as elements from Greek philosophy. And I have talked about the influence of Greek philosophy on Christian theology, and so let me give you a very brief introduction to the major Greek philosophical schools. And what I want you to pay attention to is the main elements of the schools and be on the lookout for ways that those might creep into Christianity. The first is the Epicureans. This was probably the least influential and rather short-lived. They believed that all of truth comes by means of sensual perception, by means of the five senses. Well, they share that. There is no immortality. This world is all there is. And our goal in life, the thing that's important, is to pursue happiness in this life because there is no other. Now, the early Epicureans believed that you had to pursue happiness with a long-term perspective. That is, on the long run, what will bring you the most happiness? And so they taught that you need to live a moral life because that is what brings happiness on the long term. So they were proponents of a strict morality, and they devoted their time to study and contemplation for the most part. Needless to say, the Epicureans tended to be the wealthy. It was later on that followers of Epicureanism gave it its bad name, namely, they pursued happiness on the short run, with a short-term perspective. So whatever brings me happiness right now, that's what I should do. These are the later Epicureans. But that's not the way it was in the first couple centuries of our era. The next one, the Pythagoreans. And this is the one that I understand the least. Yeah, they were always... Well, it's the same Pythagoras. I understand this school the least. And I would be interested in reading some of it to see if I could figure out what was attractive about it. Well, it's a long period of time. They all started like the 5th and 4th century BC, but they become popular in Roman culture about the 1st century BC to 1st century AD. They become very popular. Pythagoreans came from Pythagoras, the discoverer of the famous theorem. They believed that the way to know that which is true is through a study of numbers and ratios, and thus a preoccupation with triangles. The soul is the essence of man, not the body. Now that, we're going to see, is a common thread that runs through all these other philosophical schools, is the separation of the material body and that which indwells the material body. And that becomes very important when we talk about Christian doctrine. He believed that the soul is the essence of man and not his body. And what I was saying is that all these other philosophical schools will make that distinction between the material part of man and his soul. He believed in the transmigration of souls. The soul is eternal. It just moves from body to body, or place of habitation to place of habitation. Typically, it moves from body to body. No, there are many souls.
Many souls.
But no soul dies.
I mean, the body reincarnation.
Well, as I understand it, there is a distinction between transmigration of souls and reincarnation, but I don't know what that is. Technically, there's a difference, but I'm not sure what it is.
It looks like it.
As to my knowledge, it's about the same thing.
But they didn't define that as eternal? I mean, are you not defining it as we understand eternal?
The soul is eternal.
Okay, that's Okay. You said it wasn't.
No, the soul is eternal. It always existed and always will exist. It's immaterial. It's only the material that passes away.
Well, then, according to that theory, there would be a fixed population of souls that never change.
Right.
So the population of bodies can never exceed the population of souls.
I would think so.
So you have some unhoused souls. But have souls waiting for a body.
But not every soul has a body at any given time. A human body, at least. A soul didn't necessarily have to always be inhabiting a body.
But a body always had to have a soul.
A living body always had a soul. Speaking of the cynics, the next group are the cynics. They believe that the goal in life is to become independent of the desires of one's material body. Because there's this soul that's contained inside this material body, but the material body is constantly making demands on the soul and thus dictating what that soul does. So our goal in life is for the soul to deny the demands of the body and reach independence. So they tended to be the back to nature people of that culture. They go out and live in caves and
wear stocks.
Yeah, and put burlap sacks on and that sort of thing. As time went on, cynics became, it wasn't so much get back to nature, but to go against any social convention. So any kind of outlandish behavior was fair game, something that attracted them. It's kind of interesting to look back at different types of history and see parallel elements with our own culture. There are always differences, but it's interesting to look at similarities. Stoicism. Pythagoreans, I should put Stoics.
Stoics.
Well, I don't know quite what the evolution of their thinking was, but originally it was to get back to nature, that is, to get away from society and go out where you can be alone with yourself and where you will not have the temptations and that of society. As it evolved, though, it wasn't so much get back to nature, but it was just to rebel against society. The Stoics, they believe that there is some kind of divine reason behind all of the created universe, and the job of man is to determine what that underlying logic, what that underlying reason is, and to live according to it. So they tended to be very moral. They lived strict moral lives. But they too believe that the soul is a divine element that indwells a material body. It's enslaved to that material. It's trapped in that material body. However, by living a moral life, a man can rise above his circumstances. It doesn't matter what's happening to him if he keeps in perspective that his job is to live in harmony with the created order, with the divine reason. And if he does that, it doesn't matter what happens to his physical body. And that's where we get the word stoicism. They rise above the circumstance, the whatever circumstance, the present circumstances. Because they don't matter. As long as the divine spark that's in the soul of man is doing what is moral, then he's doing what he's supposed to be doing. He's living in harmony with the creator, with divine reason. There was a quote in Schaff that was very interesting, where he compared Stoicism with Christianity. He says, on the one hand, Stoicism is the philosophical school that is closest to Christianity, in that both of them stress very heavily
the need to live in accordance with the created order, that is, to live moral lives. But on the other hand, they couldn't be farther apart, because Stoicism leads to arrogance and to independence from God, a feeling of autonomy. And Christianity denounces that as being the worst of evils. It's a good quote. I wish I'd got it. The last one is that I will talk about is Platonism. The reason I won't... Aristotelian thought really becomes more important later on, so I'm going to skip that. And it was not all that significant at this time period. Platonic philosophy of all of these was probably the most significant at this time period, especially on the church. I don't know that it was the most popular. I don't know if that would be true or not. But the elements of Platonic thought you find everywhere. You don't necessarily find the elements of these others everywhere. But the elements of Platonic thought, you certainly see them in Christianity very heavily. So of all of these schools, it's the Platonists that influenced Christianity the most. Plato believed that true knowledge can only be of... These are Platonists. I don't know that I know the difference, but these are Platonists.
Yeah, exactly. I heard that.
Neoplatonism, as I understand it, well, it just turns weird. It combines with Pythagorean thought, as well as mixing in magic and some other things, if I'm not mistaken. Plato believed that you cannot... True knowledge cannot be obtained with respect to the material world. If you can see it, you cannot have true knowledge of it. And the reason you can't have true knowledge of it is because whatever it is, over time, it will be different. The reason you can't have true knowledge of it is because if it is material, over time, it will be different. So, for instance, this book. You cannot have true knowledge of this book because in 10 years, it will be different. It will have aged. Anything that can be perceived, you cannot have knowledge of that thing, true knowledge of that thing. That will change as well. But he defines true knowledge as that which is universal, always true at every time and every place. As a result, true knowledge can only be had of those things which are immaterial. So, So it's impossible to have true knowledge of this book, but it is possible to have true knowledge of the, what's he called? We'll call it the beatific form. It is possible to have knowledge of the form of which this is a particular instance. That is, it is possible to have true knowledge of books. And this is a particular manifestation of the form books. And those forms are called ideas. In Greek, idea, which means an image or form. So Plato is called an idealist because he believes that what is real, what is permanent, what is unchanging, is the universal form that lies behind every particular object. So it is our job, those who are seeking true wisdom, to discover those ideas, those forms.
Concepts.
No, he's talking about everything. He's talking about principles.
Okay.
There are universal principles out there to be observed, as I understand it. Not just objects, but there are principles, universal principles out there to be learned. What is the idea, the form?
Yeah.
Well, the word that's always used is bookness. That every book participates in bookness.
bookness being the idea and this being the particular.
Well, bookness, eternal.
Bookness is eternal.
Bookness is eternal.
Eternal, and it does not change. Mm-hmm. And all of these ideas emanate from the one, and that is God. So I include words on a page. If it didn't have words on a page, my guess is he would say, then it's not a book because it does not share in bookness, because part of sharing in bookness is having words on it. Yeah, empty bookness, which is another idea. It's an idea whose time has come. Well, Plato, not to things, but to principles, yes. And principles, as I understand it, are also ideas.
And are they always good? Or are they back and forth?
They're always principles.
They're always principles, true principles. And a bad action is contrary to true principles.
Well, he talks about...
Let me read. Well, let me see if I can cover all this stuff. I'm no expert on Platonic philosophy. Let me talk about it a little bit more, and then I'll read you a quote from him, and maybe that'll be helpful. According to his understanding, body and soul are distinct. And that's something that we've talked about before. The soul being one of those ideas. And the soul needs to be... The soul is not willingly bad. It is just ignorant. And that soul needs to be trained. It needs to be educated to learn to distinguish, to see that the point of real knowledge is the ideas and not the particulars. He gives the example, his famous example is, if you have a bunch of people in a cave, you've probably seen this. This is all in a cave. And here's the back of the cave. And here are people sitting in the cave looking at this wall. And there's a fire burning back here. And we have people walking back and forth here. These people sitting in the cave are looking at this wall, and they see the reflections, they see the shadows that are cast by these people walking back and forth. Well, what they are seeing are the particulars, like this book. It's not the thing walking back and forth, it is just a reflection. It's just a shadow of the thing that's walking back and forth. Now, if you took these people outside, out here, so that they could see the fire and see what's happening, then they could see the real objects. And that would be a step forward, because then they'd see what is real, what's important. Furthermore, if you could take them out into the sun, they could see things as they really are all around them, as illuminated by the sun. And in fact, they could see the sun itself, the source of all light. That's the goal of life. That's the analogy that he uses. But he points out that most of these people, if you unchained them and took them out where the light was, it would hurt their eyes, and they would prefer to go back into the cave and stare at the wall. That would be their preference. And people have to be brought to the place where they see that it's preferable to see things illuminated by the sun and see the sun itself. Okay, so education is necessary to help people to understand that it's the ideas that
are... So the people...
These... Well, as I don't recall all the particulars, but these are the forms. These are the ideas.
But this is the form.
Well, these are the forms.
So
these are the particulars, the shadows cast on the wall.
Shadows cast on the wall of the book and the people walking back
bookness.
And forth, the bookness.
And out here, the sun is the one.
Sun is the one.
That's God. Well, I don't know why he has both the sun and the fire.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. He has several levels. There are two levels of ideas and there are two levels of the tangible world. For instance, mathematics, he's got the, I hope I'm getting these right. There's the dianoia, and there's the noesis. And the dianoia is like mathematics. These are both in the ideal world, but there are two levels. This is mathematics, and this is like the character of God or something. Let me read you some quotes from Plato. Plato is, if you haven't read Plato, you should. It's very interesting. The way that he arrives at moral values is very perceptive. And you can see why what he says would be attractive to Christians. And a lot of Christians were very much attracted to him. Let me read you this section from the Republic. First of all, then, the unjust man. We're trying to figure out what is a just man and what is an unjust man. First of all, then, the unjust man. Let him act as expert craftsmen do. The tip-top pilot, for example, or physician, distinguishes what is possible and what is impossible in his art. He undertakes the one and not the other. Besides, if he happens to make any slip, he is able to recover. Just so, the unjust man will undertake his injustices in the right way, and then he must not be found out if he is to be great in wrongdoing. One who is caught must be considered a bad workman, for the extreme injustice is to be thought just when one is not. So we must grant to the perfectly unjust perfect injustice and take nothing away. But we must allow the one who does the greatest wrongs to get the greatest fame for justice, and to recover if he does make a slip. He must be able to persuade if he is denounced for his wrongdoings, and to compel whenever force is needed, because of his courage and strength and because of his store of wealth and friends, as Aeschylus says. So we must take away the seeming, for if he is to be thought just, honor and gifts will be his because he is thought just, and then it would not be clear whether he were such because of his justice or because of the gifts and honors. He must be stripped naked of all but justice, and made the opposite of the former, doing no wrong. Let him have the greatest possible repute of injustice, that he may be tested for justice through not being softened by infamy and all that comes of it. So let him go on his way unchanging until death, believed to be unjust all through life while he is just, that both may go to the extreme, one of justice and one of injustice, and it may be judged which of them is happier and more fortunate. Lord bless us, my dear Glaucon, that's his interlocutor, I said. How forcibly you do carve them out and polish them up like a pair of statues for a competition. I do my best, he said. There they both are, and, as I think, it is no longer difficult to discuss what kind of life awaits each, so now I must go on. And if my words are rather rough, don't suppose me to be speaking, Socrates, but those who praise injustice above justice. This is what they will say. The just man, in those circumstances, will be scourged, racked, chained, have his eyes burnt out. At last, after every kind of misery, he will be set up on a pole. And he will know that one ought to wish not to be just, but to seem just. And the words of Aeschylus were then much more rightly applicable to the unjust. For they will say that really the unjust man practices a thing which clings close to truth, and he does not live for opinion. He wishes not to seem to be unjust, weeping from furrow deep within his mind whence careful counsels grow. First he will hold public office because he is thought to be just. Then he will marry into any family he chooses and give his children to marry anyone he chooses, and make partnerships and contracts with any he likes. And besides all this, he will benefit by gaining profit because he does not mind being unjust. In legal actions, private or public, he will overcome and get the better of his enemies. And by this he will grow rich and able to benefit a friend and hurt an enemy, and to sacrifice and dedicate offerings to the gods properly and magnificently, and to serve gods and men, if he will, much better than the just, so that he may reasonably expect that the gods will care for him more than for the just man. So they say, Socrates, that both gods and men have provided better life for him and for the just. Okay, this is, his interlocutor is claiming that it's by this, that the truly just man is going to suffer all these horrible fates, including being tied up on a pole, set up on a pole. the truly unjust man will go on to live a very prosperous life and everything will go well for him. Then Socrates is going to turn around and refute that. But the thing that's particularly striking about that is this was written 300 some BC. And you can see how this would be appealing to a Christian reading this and basically predicting the fate of Jesus. Later in the same book, he explains what God must be. And here you'll see how Socrates' reputation is no... All Glaucon is pointing out here is that if you look at the world and see how it works, it appears to be most beneficial to be unjust, truly unjust. Socrates refutes that and says, it may appear that way, but that's not true. The real principle is that one ought to be just. And I think Christians would agree with that analysis. I won't read this, it's too long. But he talks about what qualities must God have. And the important thing is that God must be unchanging. That's what he talks about here. The idea is, if it's mutable, that the problem with the material world is it's all mutable and all changes. And Plato's argument is God perfect? And the answer is yes, God is perfect. Well, if he is mutable and he changes, then would he be perfect? And the answer is no, then he would not be perfect. Therefore, God must not change. Of immutability?
Yeah.
Well, it's not dealt with in those terms. The immutability of God is in his purposes. In the Old Testament concept, the immutability of God is in his purposes, in his standard of what is right and wrong. That's what's immutable. But as to whether God could become man, I don't think there's anything in Old Testament theology that would say that that kind of mutation is impossible. I mean, it does look a little strange, I think, from the Old Testament perspective, but I think, in fact, it's not contradictory to it. But that's not... It says that God is... Or isn't that the quote? God is the same today, yesterday, and tomorrow. What's being talked about there is God's purposes and his standard of what is right and wrong. It's not saying that God doesn't age, God doesn't change hair color or something like that. So it's immutability in a certain... Socrates was killed because he was an atheist. And to be an atheist in Greek culture means to not believe in the Greek gods. Don't believe. If you don't believe in the gods of society, you are an atheist. Socrates was put to death for being an atheist. Socrates believed in the gods, but Socrates primarily he believed in his philosophical God, the God that he arrived at through philosophical inquiry, and that is the One. Well, I can't say that I really understand the One. Apparently it is that Godhead from which all ideas emanate. But that kind of language doesn't make a lot of sense to me, but that's the kind of thing that's talked about. For all intents and purposes, the Greek gods they're out of the picture when you're talking about Platonic philosophy and Socrates' dialogues. They really don't enter in. His concern is that matter changes. Therefore, you cannot know anything that's material. Anything that's material is inferior because it's temporary and changeable. God, therefore, could not be material. He has to be immutable because only immutable things are universal and unchanging. That's not an idea that he entertained that I'm aware of. There's an idea behind it. God has to be impassionate. If God has passions, that means he changes. If he gets excited, if he gets angry, that's all change. That cannot be true of God. That is all allegorized away. That is, by the Christians who buy into Platonic philosophy, and we'll see that in this respect, all of the leading theologians did. They have to explain that away by allegory, generally. God is not personal. In Platonic philosophy, God is not personal. He's totally other. He is unknowable. He's unapproachable. Gnosticism, then, drew from elements of Greek philosophy, mixed it with the mystery religions from the East and a few other things, and put it together and came out, and mixed in some Christianity, and came out with a new thing. Schaff says, Gnosticism is the grandest and most comprehensive form of speculative religious syncretism known to history. It consists of Oriental mysticism, Greek philosophy, Alexandrian, Thelonic, and Kabbalistic Judaism, and Christian ideas of salvation, not merely mechanically compiled, but as it were, chemically combined. And what he means by that is you get something completely new by mixing them all together. Well, there are a whole family of religions that were imported from the East that required to become a member of that religion, you had to pay, generally you paid a large sum of money, and were initiated into that religion. And you went through a mystery rite to be initiated. And you were not to disclose what happens in that rite to anyone. That's why it's called a mystery religion. Generally, it entailed the killing of some animal and drinking its blood or having its blood poured on you or something like that. For instance, the Mithraic sites are, you can see them in Rome under most every old church. There's a little shrine there.
And is that something to do with a bull?
Yes, that's the one where they killed a bull. The bull was up on a scaffolding kind of thing. They killed it, and the initiate was underneath, and the blood dripped down on the person. Well, that's what happens in Gnosticism, is things are combined. But you see the elements from the different things where they overlap, that helps them to combine them. And it's combined differently in the different kinds of Gnosticism. Pelikan says, Gnosticism may be defined as a system which taught the cosmic redemption of the spirit through knowledge. And those are the two important elements of Gnosticism. There is redemption of the spirit, and the means by which that redemption is obtained is through knowledge, gnosis. There are a whole bunch of kinds of, there are a lot of different varieties of Gnosticism, but the elements, for the most part, are the same. One element, matter is evil and God is, and spirit is good. That which is spiritual is good, that which is material is evil. As a result, they reread the Old Testament. The God and creator of the Old Testament is a bad guy. And Jesus was sent by the good guy God. And the bad guy God, the creator, is the one who took that which is immaterial in us, that is the spirit, and he locked it into a body, imprisoned it in a body. And it is from that body that we need to be redeemed. It is from the material world that we need to be redeemed. No, they're two different. In most of these systems, there are two different gods. There's the creator God, and then there's the real God. And for most of history, the real God sat up in heaven, sat on his hands, and didn't do anything. And the creator God was busy making this world and putting spirits into bodies and that sort of thing. That's the God. The creator God is the God of the Old Testament, the bad guy. That's not good because he's taking that which is eternal and good and putting it into matter, which is bad. There are two gods. Uh-huh. The creator God, he created this world. He's the one who entrapped spirits in these bodies. But for most of history, the real God, the good guy God, was just sitting around watching, just sitting up in heaven watching, not doing anything. Until the time of Christ. Time of Christ, he sent Christ down to show us that that's the reality. We are spirits trapped in bodies.
So then,
and to show us the way out. Christ looked like a man, but he was not a man. And that's called docetism. From dakeo, to seem, docetism says that Jesus seemed to be a man, but he wasn't. And generally what they say happened was, well, there are all kinds of different schemes, but one is that Christ came down and indwelt Jesus when he reached manhood, and then he left just before the crucifixion. He checked out just in time. The Gnostics are docetists, okay. Yes. Spirit was released at the resurrection. The resurrection. The Spirit was released. Two gods. Now, oftentimes he's equated with Satan. He was always supreme. So Jesus could not be made a person, obviously. He had to only appear to be a person. He could not suffer because God cannot suffer. One great quote from Pelikan that I have to read is, "It was the reality of the world of locusts, crocodiles, and sex that raised for Marcion the celebrated question of the meaning of Luke 6:43, the question of the origin of evil." Basically, throughout this, it's the idea, how could a creator God who makes crocodiles, mosquitoes, and has people reproduced via sex, and has babies born through the sloppy process of being born out of a woman, how could that creator God be good? That's their perception of things. And obviously it's influenced by the Greek philosophy, which is already saying matter is bad. Now, what they taught was that Jesus, after he was resurrected, he came and talked to the apostles for that period of time, 40 days or whatever it is. During those 40 days, he gave them gnosis. And he passed, some of the apostles knew the gnosis, that is, the passwords and everything that are necessary to get you from, after you die, to get your spirit out of this material world. And that was passed down through various teachers. And these Gnostic teachers received that which was passed down orally. It's not in the scripture. This is information that's not in the Bible. It's not in the New Testament. It's gnosis. And the way you get it is you go and you listen to one of these Gnostic teachers. And they will give it to you. And once you learn that gnosis, when you die, you'll know the mumbo jumbo that's necessary to get free of this material world. So that is the salvation that Gnosticism brings. It's salvation from this material world. And it's what you need to know in order to escape this material world. That is not clear exactly what the nature of that gnosis is, whether it's a list of facts. I know that in some places there were passwords that were necessary, but I don't know whether it goes beyond that or not. But it's something that could be transmitted by teaching. It could be. Raise that question again later in the course. Very quickly, the Marcionites. Most of the Gnostic religions, they considered themselves schools of thought. They didn't really see themselves as being outside the church, and they didn't really affect the church all that much. The most significant threat to the church were the Marcionites. And the reason is because Marcion was excommunicated from the church and he started another church, and that church grew very rapidly. And there was a chance that the Marcionite religion would replace Orthodox Christianity. What he did is he went through the Old Testament. He said the Old Testament is a creation of Satan. It is the creation of the bad guy God. Then he went through the New Testament and he threw out sections of it. In fact, he threw out most of the New Testament. What he retained was the Gospel of Luke and most of the epistles of Paul. and in particular Galatians. And he claimed that all of the knowledge that we need is there in the Bible that he still had left. And that rightly understood, we can see that Jesus came to give us the gnosis which would allow us to be freed from our material bodies. Now, the interesting thing that is pointed out by Pelikan as well as Gonzalez is that in some ways the Marcionites understood biblical Christianity better than the Orthodox Christians of that time. Because the Orthodox Christians of that time saw Jesus as a new lawgiver. And what Pelikan points out is you could remove Christ from their Christianity and you wouldn't have anything different. The only role that Christ played in that understanding of Christianity is he brought the new laws, but that's all. Marcion understood, and furthermore, in Orthodox Christianity, there was really nothing to be saved from. Salvation was kind of a meaningless term. This is 2nd century AD. At least Marcion understood that there's something to be saved from. He thought we had to be saved from the material world. Well, that's not quite right, but at least he understood that there's something to be saved from. In Orthodox Christianity at that time, there was not the conception of needing to be saved from anything. That, yes, that Christ was key. It had to have been God himself to come down and give us that gnosis. According to Orthodox Christianity at this time, anybody could have given the laws. Anyone could have served as a vehicle to give those laws, much like Moses gave them in the Old Testament. It didn't have to be the Son of God. But in the Marcion understanding, it had to be an immaterial representative of the true God that could reveal the gnosis. And it only an immaterial representative of God.